You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and today is the 28th of September, 2022. I thank everyone, as always, for their support, financial and otherwise. My merchandising, of course, is still there. My other website, the Orthodox Nationalist, WordPress.com is where you can get all of this stuff, the books and access to Patreon and everything else. I strongly recommend you check this stuff out. I have several books in the works. The Nominalism one is nearing publication. It's finished and it is nearing publication. Books, unfortunately, are very frustrating to get out in any kind of a timetable, but this is fairly close. So, two things that are of interest, and one is actually related to the topic today. The first, it should be no surprise that the referenda in the four regions, Zaporozhye, Kherson, and of course New Russia itself, all have voted in huge numbers to become a part of the Russian Federation. This is clearly no surprise. I think Kherson is the lowest at 85%, and of course New Russia is 98.7, whatever it is. You've had election observers from 100 electoral commissions. I saw the report from Germany, South Africa, both of whom said that there was not only no irregularities, but it was extremely transparent. There were hundreds of observers there. So far, there's no claims to anything. And it really would be silly to claim that, because not only the deliberate shelling and destruction of Russian-speaking areas, the banning of Russian language, the utter destruction and demolition of the economy, and of course seeing the very opposite occur in Russia and Crimea, the fact that it's pretty much 100% everywhere is no surprise, despite the fact that the Americans, through their Ukrainian auxiliaries, stepped up their shelling and attacks on the voting, which occurred over the weekend, starting on Friday. Italy was one of the observers, said the same thing, and of course there we have something else which isn't a big surprise. The some version of the nationalist movement has taken over and did very well. You figure the nationalist parties taken together took about 45%. In a snap election, not surprisingly, the EU threatened them if they vote the wrong way. But as I've already discussed on this show, Italy's had a great skepticism of the EU for a long time. This might be just what they need to finally get out of it. They gain nothing from it, especially since now their elections are being controlled or attempted to be controlled by Brussels and NATO headquarters. But when you invade a country with foreigners who then completely dominate violent crime in the major cities, and then everyone is thrown in prison if you say anything against it, the auto-demolished economy, energy, and everything else, the infantile attacks on Russia, I'm not sure what you expect. If the voting is going to be honest, they're going to vote for a nationalist and populist candidate. This is why electoral control for these people is so important. And given those facts, and actually I wanted to do this topic before this became clear, I'm going to do another treatment of Machiavelli. Machiavelli is useful for a lot. I've done this before. Some people will tell you that Machiavelli is the birth of political science, with the stress on science, because it has nothing to do with ends, only regularities, law-bound behavior. What state does what kind of state does what? What does it take to hold on to power, etc.? And so for this, I go to four sources. The three major works, Discourses of Prince and Florentine Histories by Machiavelli, and Leo Strauss's Thoughts on Machiavelli, which is the best secondary source out there on this. Whatever's coming out of academia now is useless, of course. But Machiavelli is instructive for a whole bunch of reasons. There's negative reasons, in the sense that this is how tyrants operate. This is the language that they use. This is a form of manipulation. And positive, that there's much to learn from him. And neutral ones that are simply just stating facts. This is how things are. Political science as such will tell you that justice really isn't relevant, or that justice is the same thing as procedures, procedural justice, they call it, and not something transcendent. That means there are really no universal ends that to be pursued. There's only means of staying in power. My very first course in political theory in 1990, I should say, Victor DeLugan said that Machiavelli is talking about people who are aware that they have no right to rule. They know this is true. And therefore, to stay in power, they have to manipulate not just the population as a whole, but all classes of the population. You didn't have a concept of the masses then. That's purely an industrial, urbanized phenomenon. Machiavelli's writing during the Renaissance. Leo Strauss makes the point that because of all of this, Machiavelli is the first modern theorist and the ultimate revolutionary in politics, despite the fact that Machiavelli couches a lot of his arguments in classical terms. Now, sometimes you hear about Machiavelli as this set of mafia-like strategies. You know, if you take over a state with a strong constitution, you have to do X. If you take over one with a weak constitution, Y, heteronomous versus homogeneous populations. And this all gets fed into this mental computer, and in order to maintain power under X, Y, and Z circumstances, you get a certain result. And that's not entirely true, because we'll talk about fortune or fortuna in a minute, but there is no formula. It's easy to simplify everything that way. But as far as successful manipulation, every chance circumstance, and sometimes circumstances not based on chance, create success. Now, the reason I say, I've always made the claim that Thomas Hobbes, who wrote a little bit later in Britain, is the founder of modernity and the ultimate revolutionary. And I say that only because he takes a lot of what Machiavelli said and takes it seriously, but puts it in a, you know, semi-scientific system. He puts it in a systemic form. What Machiavelli only implies, Hobbes puts out in very plain English. Machiavelli just implies this revolutionary idea that the classical ends of virtue in political society are not relevant. They're not relevant because they're not real. So Machiavelli starts off, and I'm going to be all over the place here, but in The Prince, that his theses on government derive from classical examples. Great men, he mentions Moses, Cyrus, Theseus, etc. Those who have founded or acquired kingdoms successfully. Problem is that he organizes states, not so much in terms of structure or their purpose, but rather he divides them among classes concerning the modes of acquisition. Modes of acquisition and the modes of maintenance, not their purpose. So it's a simple matter of gaining and then keeping power. Power has to be, as far as you can tell, the only real good. It's the only thing that makes any difference in all of his works. So, and he says this outright in the beginning. He is primarily concerned with those who wish to take, take over principalities on a new foundation. Not an old line or royal house, but people who want to start from scratch. Now, I mention all this because talking about using classical examples, Roman especially, some contemporary Italian ones, and the Old Testament, and this is Strauss's opinion, this is my opinion too, that this is just a way to couch far more revolutionary ideas. You could go through the discourses and see it as a traditional form of Italian republicanism, but it isn't. Like, for example, the chapter 25, and he says what was kind of implied throughout, that when he makes reference to God or the heavens, he's talking about the distribution of chance occurrences. Chance, not quite randomness, but chance circumstances that can tip the scales one way or the other. And the more unstable, you know, his problem, of course, is Italy is highly unstable, made up of many principalities of every conceivable type, you know, republics, ecclesiastical, and those with a hereditary prince. And therefore, chance is very important because there simply is no unity. He talks about miracles more having to do with taking advantage of chance circumstances. And this is where Fortuna, the goddess of chance, comes in. We use fortune, good luck. The point being, the Italian system at the time, and he did see Italy as a unified entity, because there's so many different states, so many different principalities, that chance and what appears to be almost randomness is far more important because the variables exponentially increase, which is how a relatively small prince may have tremendous success, like Pope Julius had success because of the diversity of the peninsula. And as he's writing, of course, when it comes down to it, the unification of Italy may be the primary purpose, and we'll talk about this in a minute, the primary purpose of all of his writing. But this is aimed at Lorenzo in Tuscany. But the fact, if you know, one small principality can't defeat all the others, though it's conceivable that progress could be made in that respect. But as he's building this argument, he makes a lot of claims. The one of God is probably the most significant one. Now, politics, at least to some extent, he says in some places half, but that's just for individuals as well as states. And he makes a radical distinction between the two, and like Plato would do. That chance plays a huge role in both getting and keeping power. And that this is what he means by God. If we can't come up with a clear cause or an obvious cause for a political event, we tend to think of it either as miraculous or simply random. But fortune, of course, can be controlled. That's the whole point of maintaining power, to minimize the impact of chance is the very definition of political virtue. So when a young prince takes over, he needs to make certain that he staffs his cabinet, so to speak, with those who are not his vehement enemies, but moderate enemies. And he mentions Pandolfo Peruzzi, who was all the way down in Siena. who ruled his state successfully, staffed largely by those who were, again, not bitter enemies, but very suspicious of him. Machiavelli makes a claim that because those guys have to play down their past history, it gives them the incentive to almost exaggerate their loyalty to the present state of affairs. This is why, you know, on the other hand, we have the examples of Bolshevism, the American regime, where anybody even remotely opposed to it is violently purged. There, the theory is that unity is far more important than numbers. It's artless. It's Machiavelli would see that as crude, albeit, you know, successful, at least to some extent. But dealing with enemies as well as friends is two sides of the same coin. Friends could take advantage of their position. Enemies have to exaggerate their loyalty for the sake of their own maintenance. What it all comes down to is that he uses an example of an ancient figure, Chiron, who was a centaur. He's fairly well known. He brought up Achilles and a few others. And that this becomes Machiavelli's model for how princes are to be educated. The model, of course, being a centaur, is half beast and half man. That's not an accident. He's talking about new prince. He's not talking about someone who takes power through heredity. He's talking about a new government imposing itself on a population and what it has to do. Because, again, there's no obvious right that he be there. Heredity is far too normal. Morality for him is normal, but politics isn't normal most of the time, or at least some of the time. It's certainly not in Italy at the time, or today, for that matter. But that a new prince, we might say a revolutionary government, or something close to it, has to take Chiron as a model, because there's going to be times where you use human reason, and other times where you use bestial violence. And to a great extent, and Strauss says this too, that the imitation of the bestial part of Chiron takes the place of the imitation of God. Humanism, in other words, and Strauss says this too, isn't enough. Princes have to understand humanity as such and to realize that they're capable of great good, great evil, but for the most part are pretty boring. He has to transcend the normal aspects of humanity, which should sound familiar to you. He has to transcend humanity in the direction of the subhuman if he can't or doesn't transcend it in the other direction for the superhuman. And that's Strauss's interpretation, but it makes a lot of sense. So he may couch his argument in saying that this is a traditional understanding of political power using Old Testament and Roman and Greek examples, mythical or otherwise. It doesn't matter if they're mythical or not. There's still a teaching to be found there. That isn't what he's doing. Like Thomas Hobbes was going to make. And Thomas Hobbes is also a Renaissance figure, though a bit later. He's not talking about that. He's talking about a brand new teaching. New regimes, new states. But he can't come out and say that because there really was no intellectual vocabulary for it. This is part of what the Renaissance really was. So he may give specific forms of advice, you know, what to do in homogenous states versus heterogeneous states, something like that, versus a general teaching. Now, general teaching may be revolutionary. The particular one may not be. And a general teaching might look better if it leads to a particular idea that's reasonable, honorable, or praiseworthy. And the end here is the final chapter of the Prince. That is the unification of Italy. This is close to a sacred end that he has. And it's almost as if, because this is his ultimate purpose, the more violent, bestial elements of his teaching are okay, because they're means towards this exalted end. The point of him writing it to Lorenzo, and in some ideological way, to liberate Italy on patriotic grounds. He even uses the phrase common good, which in Machiavellian Hobbes doesn't really exist. So, as Strauss says, he creates the impression that all of these very terrible bestial acts, rules, and counsels don't exist because I'm a revolutionary. It exists because I want the wonderful end of a unified and independent Italy, which at the time was itself a revolutionary idea. It wouldn't be today, but it was at the time. Now, he also mentions the common good, which is the classical end. And Strauss spent a lot of time on this. Machiavelli does not. It doesn't mean it's not important, though. Chapter 26, very end of The Prince. This expectation of an Italian ethnic uprising against the foreign occupation. Foreign occupation, which is motivated at least in part by religion. But even there, it's a sleight of hand. Because in order for Italy to be unified such that it could rise up against, whether it be the French king or whoever, requires a total revolution in thought and action anyway. You would have to break every taboo of traditional morality when it comes to political rule and preach it openly. So while he'll say that my end is a good one, that is to say the liberation of Italy from foreigner, of course the idea of ethnicity is an ancient one, so there's nothing odd about that, but it would mean that there has to be some unified movement amongst the population as such, no matter what principality they may happen to live in. That in and of itself requires a total revision of the moral code when it comes to politics. So there's no, the point of it all is that there's no doubt that this is a revolutionary book. He's not giving a warning to anybody. I know that's an old myth a few people maintain. No, he's very clear about it. So now whether or not he knew this was not possible at the time. So to use it sounds more like a way to couch the language than or a way to justify everything he's saying rather than simply saying power is good in its own right. Not much in his thought says, well, this is also we can liberate Italy. He says that in the last chapter of The Prince. And for the most part, that's it. This isn't, you know, it's not a justification. It is only rhetorically, not in reality. He does believe power is the only good. A major theme beyond that in Machiavelli is, of course, the relation between Christian and pagan states and their approaches to political science. I've asked the question 100 times. I'm not entirely sure what paganism is. There's no creed. There's no authoritative source. So Machiavelli wants to provide this. And he says that Christianity, he means Catholicism. Remember, this is the Renaissance. That it's lowered the esteem for the honor of the world, so to speak. It isn't so much that, you know, it's not praiseworthy to gain it, but gaining it isn't the highest end. Paganism sees honor as the highest good. And he says because of that, pagan rulers were far more ferocious than Catholic ones. He doesn't deny the truth of the church, though. It's just that as far as political power is concerned, it's a problem, at least in his public writings. He doesn't say that this obsession with worldly honor is a delusion. But he can't hold both. He can't hold that Christianity is true on the one hand, and yet the pagan desire for power as the ultimate end is true on the other hand. And he says, probably the strongest statement, he says, it is truer than every other truth in the world that where men are not soldiers, this is due to the fault of the prince. He fully admits that Christianity is true, just not very good for political power. And he even says that pagan Rome was established through heavenly inspiration in the sense we've used the term. The truth that he puts out is that the warlike Roman Republic is a model. Machiavelli also says Christianity saw the true way. And he has to come to grips with that, as Strauss would say. What characterizes Christianity relative to paganism is not its truth or falsehood, but the problem of lowering the esteem for worldly glory, or its approach to humility, contempt for the things of the world. So he defines the two, one that says that worldly honors are not the highest good, and in and of themselves aren't good, except in the most relative sense, where pagans see public honors, military honors especially, as the highest good there is, which is another way of saying the state is the highest good there is. It's a myth to say that Machiavelli held Christianity weakens a population. He is very well aware that you've had massive Christian Orthodox empires all over the world. And like you know, Nietzsche will say much later, the effeminacy that he sees around him isn't due to the church as such, but to a very eccentric and false interpretation of it. And he comes out and says, well, Christian nations, monarchies, exalt and promote the defense of the fatherland, so to speak, and therefore Christians have to be militant and strong in that department. So that's not the issue then. If people want to put that in Machiavelli's mouth, he didn't say that. But there is a decline of the love of freedom. That has nothing to do with the church. And he says this began when the Roman Empire took over the republics of Italy itself as well as to the east. The weakness and servility that prevailed in the Christian world has nothing to do with that. It has to do with the nature of empire itself. The church isn't the cause of weakness. In fact, he's impressed by the fact that the church, the Catholic Church at the time, which was in a bad state with the Medici's controlling Rome, it has a tremendous ability to renew itself. He mentions explicitly, and he refers to it as his religion, our religion, he says. He talks about the mendicant order, St. Francis, St. Dominic, that these guys, it's even something that someone like Nietzsche would make can make sense out of. They restored Christianity almost on a revolutionary ground, despite the fact that it is the ancient teaching. And these new orders, which renewed the church entirely, prevented the rot of the prelate at the time from getting out of hand. Now, he says something interesting about these. You know, these are, you know, especially Franciscans, this is a revolutionary development here at a time of decadence. Machiavelli says, they give the people to understand that it is evil to speak evil of evil, and it is good to live in obedience to them, and if they err, to let God chastise them. That they do the worst they can, they do not fear that punishment which they do not see and which they do not believe. So, he's talking about the ability to use rhetoric against evildoing. That to discourage that kind of speech is a symptom of a broader problem. But he does point out that there is, at his time, a neglect of law and of punishment. And that means that either the evils will be eventually corrected, as he just said, through extra-legal revolution, or society dies. One of the two. Now, what we're trying to say is the prohibition against speaking evil of evil, the prohibition of the rejection of resisting evil, is the problem. As people become more decadent, good and evil become blurred. This is both a cause and an effect of this. The non-resistance to evil, which no one in their right mind could ever possibly preach and make sense out of it, because it will guarantee the total, the continuous rule of the evil. Evil is easy, the good is difficult. And Machiavelli claims that resistance to evil, and he's not defining that here, but resistance to evil is natural. It's as natural to man as anything else. It's just a form of collective self-preservation. So anyone who talks about the non-resistance to evil, ultimately is hypocritical. Now, as far as the ecclesiastical states are concerned, the papal states, he had a problem with, again, it's not so much the truth of Christianity, it's what it might represent. The clerical rule, he says, is the worst, because commands coming from revelation or any kind of divine authority aren't subject to any kind of approval. This isn't something you can have a referendum on, although, you know, the British Reformation may disagree with that. That there is no way for there to be any responsibility to the state. And the ecclesiastical principalities technically were not armed. And all they had was this divine authority. And of course, then resistance is equally impossible so long as the ecclesiastical polity maintains the doctrine, which of course is a big if. The rulers have nothing to fear only so long as the doctrine is maintained. And what Machiavelli seems to forget is just that. The church is either accepted or it's rejected. It either a popular or an unpopular institution. It is most certainly amenable to an overall longitudinal referendum. And virtue isn't even the issue, according to him. It's the ability to faithfully reflect divine authority. But that is automatically a limitation on it. So his criticism of ecclesiastical polities is very strange. He assumes that they are faithful to the doctrine. Well, nothing creates revolution and violence and rebellion more than the imposition of heresy. We see it in Russia, we see it in Byzantium, we see it everywhere. Guarantees either the state's going to be torn apart or maybe destroyed entirely. Resistance is forbidden if and only if the people ruling such a state are faithful. And when they're not, they lose all the legitimacy that they have. So Machiavelli's concept of the ecclesiastical or, you know, theocracies is completely false. And I think, you know, he knew enough theology to know that that's probably way too simplistic. Now, it's often said that Machiavelli justifies cruelty. He gives a lot of examples as to what cruelty might mean. And for a revolutionary system, a new prince in an older state has to develop a limited reputation for cruelty. And he uses the example of Hannibal. And he used what he called inhuman cruelty. And he says that this is because he ruled over an army that was, Hannibal did, that was very heteronymous. It consisted of all races. Therefore, the only thing that unifies such a body is fear of the person who rules you. So an ethnically homogeneous society is far more just and is far easier to rule and is far less tumultuous and requires much less cruelty than what we call a diverse system. Now, of course, the armies of Carthage being taken, you know, this was a commercial republic. Men were taken from all over the empire, really mercenaries from all over the world, that the only way to keep them together is to treat them or to react to even small infractions in a very cruel way, in an inhumanly cruel way. But even then, they weren't mixing them. They all had their own unit. So people will talk about a cosmopolitan Constantinople. Well, no, it was a Greek city. But, you know, the Italian section or the Jewish section, these were segregated areas. So you can't talk about a cosmopolitan city means that those differences don't matter. Those differences did matter in the ancient world. And in that sense, the way that cities were designed, especially major cities, the only way that multiple races could be ruled is that they don't mix. Back then, ethnicity mattered even more than it does now. And several of the more important ethnic groups, Armenians, Italians, Jews, a few others, in Constantinople, you had a quarter, which, especially in the Russian example, in Moscow's example, natives couldn't go into, something that Peter the Great did in the German section of Moscow. But he goes farther than this, because even in homogenous states, he said the Roman Republic was a homogenous state. That doesn't mean that cruelty or the use of extreme severity from the ruling class, not even talking about princes here, is still useful and occasionally desirable. Now, part of the reason for certain types of cruelty in terms of rule, theory being that if you react harshly in a minor matter, you nip that in the bud and you save a lot of pain later on. But Machiavelli makes a common sense argument that the apostolic commands of Christianity are extremely difficult to maintain. Ultimately, they're impossible to maintain perfectly, because they're not a closed body of law. Canons aren't a penal code. It is open in terms of grace and experience. Words are known to be limited transistors of information, transmitters of information. Now, I've made the argument, for example, in Afghanistan, since that country has been at war for so long, all public morality has collapsed, that drugs had taken over the biggest moneymaker, that a group like the Taliban was absolutely necessary. Only with that kind of, I mean, going back to the traditions, whether it be Christianity or Islam, depending on what case we're talking about, from a state of total immorality requires a certain amount of authoritarianism. Harshness that's directed and rational. But even under the best of conditions, Machiavelli would say that the Christian apostolic standards is extremely difficult. All men are sinners, therefore it's impossible in the phenomenal world to be perfect. You can in the noumenal world. In the ethereal world, in the mental world, you can, but not in the phenomenal world. And the necessity that we all sin comes from the fact that there is a huge gap between the apostolic standard and how we are constituted, especially today, and how we're raised. So for something like this, where commands of justice, where commands of the church are extremely difficult, and even go against our nature, especially in times of extreme stress, and the Afghan example is a perfect one, because nothing destroys morality like constant warfare. The only thing that matters is violence in that case. To bring a system back to its roots, to reintroduce even basic morality, is going to require a very harsh regime, at least for a while. So that goes for the church in Europe, and it goes for places that have suffered war for a long period of time. This isn't bad. It would be bad if you did it under normal circumstances. And even there, there's a certain justification. But in abnormal circumstances, a destroyed, a burning society based on rubble, you cannot expect any kind of civic order that isn't imposed from above. Now, Machiavelli doesn't really have a state of nature theory. We've talked about this for a long time. Thomas Hobbes will put Machiavelli on a more, in his mind, scientific footing a short time later. But Machiavelli does deal with whether humans are good or evil. I remember that being the very first philosophical question I ever pondered early in my college life. And I came to the conclusion that people are outside of social restraint, pretty rotten. Of course, I can't accept myself either. But Machiavelli teaches that humanity's nature, and he does talk about a nature, isn't inherently bad. Not in its creation, not as a consequence of sin or anything like that, but that they are usually corrupt. But that corruption isn't in their constitution. Their corruption comes from the regime under which he lives. And Machiavelli says that a corrupt society can only be put back together again by royal power, and the course of power of a king that can act as he sees fit. And he says that any other way of attempting to make the citizens good and virtuous would either be a cruel enterprise or simply impossible, if not both. Machiavelli's conception of morality is talked about a lot, but usually without a whole lot of understanding. Yes, it's true, power is a good in and of itself. But in talking about the nature of morality, he has to make sense out of conscience. For us, of course, conscience is how the divine world speaks to us. It's part of God's energy. And that's the ultimate standard of judgment. So long as we're not a sociopath, our conscience does tell us what to do, and we could ignore it or not. But Machiavelli tries to be as practical as he can. He says ingratitude is a tremendous vice, but that this vice comes from necessity. So given the nature of man in his time, if he is inherently a sinner, almost compelled to do the wrong thing, he shouldn't have a bad conscience about it, because it's not something he can help. But of course, that's not true. And he doesn't even claim that crime doesn't pay. Crime does pay in many cases. He goes on and on about different criminal enterprises that have led to, you know, very successful, very satisfied lives. So the satisfaction that comes from a good conscience is not necessarily as gratifying. I mean, I've always said that a good conscience is an extremely powerful weapon, but not quite as powerful in Machiavelli's mind as revenge would be, or the ultimate victory over enemies. Ultimately, he doesn't make sense out of the conscience, because you could follow the precepts, both general and particular ones, that Machiavelli lays out, and because of the nature of political rule, still be very dissatisfied with your behavior. This is something that Ivan IV in Russia suffered with his whole life. And he wasn't in a situation too far off from those who have to rebuild society from the ground up. And I use the same examples. I mean, Hitler in Germany is a classic example. You know, taking a destroyed and humiliated, broke society, broke in every sense of the term, and resurrecting it. Chung Hee Park in South Korea, one of my favorite examples. Having to remake society up from nothing. Places like South Vietnam, for example, fail completely to do that. Now, the way that he understands conscience and providence, and providence is important, especially in the era, it enables man to work out a particular destiny, except God's waiting for man to respond to. So he kind of says that regarding providence, the notion of providence, according to which God will literally govern the world as a just king governs his kingdom. That, of course, is a traditional idea. But the prosperity of the wicked and the afflictions of the good, you know, no good deed goes unpunished, has always been a perpetual problem. That's something that Machiavelli can make sense out of. But it still, over the long term, makes sense within the providential order. So, for example, you know, very common one, you know, those who live by the sword will die by it. And Machiavelli could say, and be perfectly consistent, that, well, it's not just those who live by the sword, it's also people who don't live by the sword will also perish by it. Now, providence here, let me clarify this. Man has, in Machiavelli's mind, man has an inherent constitution for sin, vice, and especially to be ungrateful. And if that's the case, then he has no reason to be grateful either. Sin isn't something that should create a bad conscience, because this is how we are, which of course doesn't answer the question. And then Machiavelli goes even farther, saying that if there's a natural necessity to sin, therefore this part of the blame belongs on God as the origin of evil. And then he says, well, you can't be expected to be grateful to such a creator. He gets blessings he doesn't deserve, but he gets sufferings that he doesn't deserve. But of course, ultimately, God isn't in the picture. He uses the word over and over again. He uses words like heaven or the heavens. But as I said in the beginning, this comes down to fortune, at least mostly to fortune. And for those who rule by chance, they just kind of fall backwards into a situation or take advantage of an immediate circumstance that they would never have been able to take over otherwise. Meaning that in many cases, and he's talking about Italy especially, people have and maintain the power they have not from any prudence of their own, not from any virtue or vice of their own. They just were in the right place at the right time, so to speak. But even a just rule, a good conscience, requires at least weaponry, a strong law enforcement presence, basic prudence, common sense, and an understanding of the history of the place where you're ruling, and, to some extent, fortune. Good luck. But Machiavelli tries to say that fortune or chance doesn't seem to be picky whether the person that we're talking about is just or unjust. That's why he says God is not just or unjust, but he is simply neutral, like in Aristotle's sense. But again, he's not talking about God. He simply uses that term. He says that in this case, God and chance are essentially one and the same thing. He even says that if injustice creates this desire for rebellion, he then says too, like Dostoevsky says, that a perfectly just state would paralyze the state, would paralyze government. Because no state can function that doesn't use a mixture, a very intelligent and informed mixture of goodness and badness, or justice and injustice. Which ultimately means that Machiavelli doesn't believe there's such a thing as justice or injustice. He just means things that appear good and things that appear bad. Later on, you see a lot of Nietzsche and a lot of this. But this is the first expression of something like this. It's the famed line that God is the one who has the strongest battalions or the strongest military divisions, the largest number of them. And so the ability to dominate chance, this is what ultimately is what virtue is. And that, in Machiavelli's mind, takes the place of providence. So yet again, we see a situation where Machiavelli deliberately uses words that at the time were very common, but gives them a different meaning. This is why Leo Strauss's conception of Machiavelli is so good. Now, again, concerning providence, we talked about the difference between pagan and Christian states. It's almost as if he reduces paganism to the Roman Republic, that Rome was founded essentially by a very violent nobility, and that's really what created the Republic. While Christianity was a popular movement, not a military one whatsoever. And Machiavelli, when he's talking about Savonarola, says that it is extremely important, and it's because of this, that the popular element usually was the element that the church supported. This goes back to its foundation. And Strauss makes the claim that the Roman counterpart to Savonarola was the plebeian leader Virginius. But if Rome, as he says, were to remain incorrupt, then men like Virginius could never play the role that people like Savonarola played in Florence. That in a just state, a prophet wouldn't be necessary because the political class, the Senate, whoever it is, would be the one to cut through the nonsense of power. Only because of injustice can someone like Virginius or Savonarola come into existence. But again, Savonarola didn't have an army behind him. He had the people behind him, certainly. And this is why, obviously, he was murdered. And he was a very saintly man. There's a different nature between Christian and pagan states. Paganism being that of the warrior aristocracy primarily. And there may be some truth to this, that this is the natural and normal course of affairs, that the military victors are the ones who should rule society, who have a right to rule the society by force. Again, Machiavelli would be very, very relevant there. where Christianity is a popular movement. And then he'll go so far as to say that the domination of the great and exalted over the weak and humble is essential for the strength of society. And he makes a claim that unarmed prophets necessarily fail. Moses was not unarmed. He was armed. But while a prophet, technically, he isn't one of their number. In fact, the greatest prophets were unarmed. Now, he's thinking of Savonarola, but Christ himself was an unarmed prophet. In fact, Machiavelli was an unarmed prophet. The prophet is someone who comes into a period of decadence and auto-demolition and brings and confronts the ruling class and brings them back to their roots. That's their purpose. Now, you could do that with an army behind you, which would be totally different than doing it without an army behind you. The Old Testament prophets, the actual College of Prophets, these were overwhelmingly unarmed. I mean, even Isaiah was. Those who are specifically called prophets. And yet their enemies are long forgotten, and their words continue to inform the church that they helped create. So the unarmed prophet in paganism wouldn't make a whole lot of sense. And Virginius and Savonarola are of two very different orders. I mean, at least Roman plebs, had numbers behind them. Numbers never mattered insofar as the prophets were concerned. Despite the prophets being very political, I mean, they laid out the political and economic familial ground of, you know, what's going to develop into Christianity later. Christ didn't speak of those things, largely because the prophets already did it, and he assumed that everyone knew what these guys said, at least to some extent. This is why he imitated in the way he did it. But he goes farther than this. He says Christianity does have political implications. Machiavelli doesn't see a political theory coming out of the Bible like I do in the Old Testament. He says one of the big differences between, now he says biblical religion. Of course, Strauss was a Jew. Machiavelli was God knows what. Of course, dealing in a mostly Catholic country, except in the South. But it doesn't matter. Christianity versus paganism. That because Christianity is a monotheistic religion, it connects itself automatically with a centralized monarch. But the pantheon of pagans seems to suggest an aristocracy, a militarized republic, where, of course, the god in Islam and Christianity is an absolute monarch. But providence isn't merely a dictate. When it comes to talking about fortune, half of man is free, half is subject to chance encounters. So paganism, he defines as the satisfaction with the present, with the present system, with the world and everything that the world can offer. But they are despairing about the nature of the future, not just the person, but also the political body, because the great pagan civilization, and correctly so, spoke of this constant trajectory of decline from the Golden Age. So they had no love for the future. Now, of course, Christianity is the opposite. They are dissatisfied. We are dissatisfied with the present world, that this world is simply misery, that the goods that it offers aren't really goods. We only fantasize that they are. That we long for purity and transformation, and that this scorn for the world is a noble virtue. So, again, this is Strauss says this as well. It kind of makes sense that pagans would see that as just misanthropy, the hatred of humanity. So, I mean, Machiavelli does have the story of Antaeus. And of course, Strauss talks about this too. If a man has his persona, and if he is armed, the best thing he could do is take his stand firmly on earth and oppose the efforts of the Egyptian Heracles. man ought to tempt fortune, try fortune, which is the goddess of this world. He shouldn't try to conquer the kingdom of heaven. Fortune is a different story. This is the ultimate problem. Antaeus was the son of the earth. All he can do was take his stand for the sake of personal glory against the Egyptian. But what it comes down to isn't personal strength, but the ability to manipulate and even dominate most of fortune. And he does speak, he does personify fortune as a person. I'm going to end talking about the nature of fortune, which is the one of these central concepts. And so much of his theory can rest on it. He does treat Fortuna as a goddess. He uses Fortuna and heaven, or the heavens, pretty much the same way. Fortuna, in fact, takes the place of the pagan pantheon. And almost, you know, trying to conquer Fortuna is something that typifies paganism as such. Now, Machiavelli's conception may be true, it may be false, but at least it's an attempt. Fortune, as a being and as a concept, is of immense power. She's someone that you have to take very seriously. That fortune could overturn the strength of armies and men. Someone who you think is chosen is in fact rejected by circumstances. And that bad fortune or ill luck is something almost inherent in politics. He says, human appetites owe it to nature that they can long and that they can wish to long for everything, that they owe it to Fortuna that they can attain only a few of those things. So nature tells us one thing. Fortune gives us something else. That fortune is responsible, at least in part, for the evils that he inflicted on Romans or anybody else. Not out of benevolence, really, but because she, and she's also always feminine, always depicted as a female goddess that demands to be recognized. And this can happen when something that seems so obvious comes crashing to the ground. Something that seems so powerful one day comes crashing to the ground the next day without any real obvious cause. And greatness comes from fortune, not just in the good things, but also in the bad things. That the disaster of the Gallic War, for example, Machiavelli says, comes at least in part because the Romans had not observed justice. But if fortune had favored Rome, then what's going on here? Fortune can blind cities or countries, much less to the extent that they are virtuous. Machiavelli treats fortune almost as a deity. She takes the place of providence in Machiavelli's system. She deals only with the way that men are governed. There's no signs, there's nothing immediately obvious about it, but you find her in everything that happens. Fortune seems to elect from a very bizarre set of criteria, certain men, certain nations for domination, and others for ruin and total destruction. It's not that she is malevolent or beneficent. She's also not all powerful, but powerful enough that she really can't successfully be opposed most of the time. Virtue, the way we've already discussed it, is in part the ability to take advantage of the circumstances that fortune throws up. Her ends are not known. And again, she's heavily personified. Clearly, Machiavelli doesn't believe in an actual Fortuna. Like most paganism, this goddess is simply a personification of something far greater and something far more powerful. And Machiavelli sounds like a current self-esteem counselor when he says, because of the nature of fortune, giving up, killing yourself, ending it all, whether literally or figuratively, is always a stupid idea. So fortune will look at, you know, we look at the Old Testament and talk about Gideon, who was deliberately told to keep his army very small so that when he won against the Midianites, it's one of my favorite judges, sort of, it won't be because of him, it'll be because of God. Now, Machiavelli would say, no, this is how Fortuna works, not necessarily God. That somehow he just tripped over a method by which he was going to defeat the Midianites, and it was thus projected onto God. As far as politics is concerned, justice and injustice, the way he defines it, these are both necessary for political rule. And as I said before, that means that there's no justice or injustice. So as he says, nature has so created men that they could long for everything and yet they can't attain everything. Discontent, anger, frustration is inherent in being human. So he'll say that the power of fortune or good luck is based on the way that nature operates. Nature and fortune are two very different things. Fortune is a part of the whole, but not even necessarily the ruling part, depending on how much virtue a society has. Now, he refers to heaven as just another word for an all-encompassing providence. So heaven establishes the form or earthly lives, function, and biology, and all the rest, the limits of which is almost impossible to expand. That doesn't mean heaven determines how we live out. Heaven always leaves room for human causation. So think of fortune belongs to the same class of things to which prudence and common sense would belong. Ill fortune or good fortune comes from fortuna. But in fact, Machiavelli says, most of the time when we consider these victories, we see that it's not just good luck. You couldn't possibly rely on that. But it also comes from human virtue. And he'll say that Rome earned her greatness based not on fortune, but on virtue. And he distinguishes this from Sparta. Not through the prudence of her founder, but through chance or accidents, which is where the Spartan power came from. And these accidents came from the discord between the ruling class and the plebeians. The point is that this confrontation is part of what made Roman virtue what it was. The humor of a people, humors, that's another word for essence in his case, the humors, dealing with the opposition, which is essential to every republican state, that either discord is dealt with or one faction is oppressed in favor of the other. Rome didn't do that. And therefore, the best of the Republican traditions come from being able to institutionalize and deal with the conflict which is inherent in all societies. In other words, conflict isn't bad. So it's not chance that Rome did very well, at least in the early years. It comes from her institutions, her prudence, her generosity, that the nobles were wise enough to institutionalize this confrontation rather than just in a crude way repress it like you have in America today. So the cause of ill luck, you know, misfortune, comes not from luck itself or fortune. But if you look closely, you'll see it comes from a lack of virtue. And that lack of virtue comes from specific causes. The point being, great men, virtuous men, rise above chance. And this is part of what greatness is. People who have their positions through luck for good fortune at any given moment don't last. That eventually is going to run out. The Stoic idea is that chance has no power over you. No matter how your luck may vary, goes up and down, you'll be the same person. So chance really can't be conquered, but you can create yourself as independent from it. And even to the extent the separation of powers, like you see in Polybius or the founding fathers of America, is a way to deal with this. No matter what happens, there'll be one faction to take over from a bad one. One group will be able to fix the problems of another one. And this, to some extent, is virtue taking over from chance. And there's no way they could have known where the society was going to go. It did fail, but it didn't fail for reasons having to do with institutions. But freedom, dignity, this is something that the great have. And it comes from knowledge. It comes from a scientific knowledge of the world, especially where luck matters and where luck doesn't matter. There is an inner freedom, a stoic freedom from chance, which comes down to, as Strauss would say, an ultimate superiority to every fear and every hope, which presupposes a recognition of chance as a real power of the natural necessities by virtue of which chance and luck rule. And of course, they rule only within certain limits. And there really are no other options. The other options are either just a blind faith or the vulgar worship of success, which essentially being leaving the world open to luck. There is no point in being educated. There is no truth worth understanding. And Machiavelli says, even when a prince becomes great, not because of chance. His good fortune actually is bad luck when enemies rise up against him, cause the prince to react. A man will then become great because he has now the occasion to overcome them and require his reputation. In fact, Machiavelli goes so far as to say that princes should even artificially create and nourish, as he says, some enmity against himself, so his reputation can be increased when he defeats them. Now, that could be taken too far, but the point is pretty clear. Difficult times are those things which seem to be amenable to bad luck. Peaceful times is the half of us that come from virtue and hence freedom. But Machiavelli will say that if men are virtuous, if they are prudent, if they know how to synthesize the knowledge of history, good luck, bad luck, they're left alone. Of course, luck favors virtue and prudence, because virtue and prudence have a respect for chance, as chance has respect for them. At the end of the chapter on that, he, of course, makes it clear fortune is like a woman who seems more powerful than they are, but they can only be vanquished by the right type of man. If fortune could be conquered, that person would then be master of all things. Fortune should not be worshipped. She should be defeated. Well, I've gone over my time here. I hope I gave a smattering of understanding of what Machiavelli really is, good, bad, and indifferent. It's an extremely complicated idea that can't be reduced to a handful of maxims about cruelty or what luck is. It comes down to a multitude of variables that are extremely hard to synthesize by one person. But at least he is attempting to be honest about all the variables that go into political science. He's wrong that there's no such thing as justice or injustice. He's wrong about his approach to Plato and approach to the church. And he most certainly tries to deceive by using language in an equivocal sense. It won't be long before I come back to Machiavelli again. In the meantime, thank you everyone for listening, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.